Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This podcast is brought to you by Safe Ireland and Airbnb, working in partnership to support domestic violence survivors across Ireland. Welcome back to the Women's Podcast. I'm Roisin Ingle. This week, as you all know, Aisling Murphy, the 23-year-old Tullamore woman who was murdered as she went for a run by the canal near her home, was buried by her family. The entire country, it feels like, has been, whether in conversations around the dinner table or at vigils by candlelight, we've been grieving and reflecting on the issues around male violence against women. We've been talking about the causes, looking at the patterns and the culture behind it. And in the Dáil yesterday, Miriam Lord was watching as Aisling Murphy's murder was described by politicians as yet another watershed moment in a struggle to end men's violence against women, a struggle that's been going on for decades with various government strategies and task forces and legislation, with none of it seeming to make much of a difference. And Miriam Lord, in her own exceptional way in the Irish Times today, is pointing at that inertia. She writes, "Bloody typical. You spend years talking about watersheds and then none of them come along at once. But that's always been the way. No wonder speakers on the unvarnished subject of violence against women sounded doubtful about what exactly will result from the latest round of government commitments sincerely announced in the wake of the latest crime to shock the nation. And who can blame them? Down through the years, the promises made on the floor of the Dáil have been many, but the track record poor. Maybe this time it will be different. Another woman dead. Another national outpouring. Another round of TDs solemnly and resolutely announcing a watershed moment. They didn't do this for the optics. On Wednesday, every politician who stood up in the chamber to declare the death of Aisling Murphy as the beginning of a major turning point in the state's strategy against gender-based violence meant every word that they said. On this issue, they always do. As a compelling and occasionally heart-gripping session drew to a close, Galway's Catherine Connolly added her voice to the overwhelmingly female chorus of hope against hope. And yes, maybe this time things will be different. But once sensed, she won't be holding her breath. Time and again, watershed moments have been declared on the floor of the Dáil following a particularly heinous act, resulting in little action down the road." So, we wanted to talk about that today. About whether this really is a watershed moment and whether it might mean something, whether it might mean that things are going to change. And joining us today to discuss that were Examiner columnist Alison O'Connor, Professor of Psychology at the University of Limerick, Orla Muldoon, final year law student Inie Kiolu and Marketing Director of CORE, Finian Murphy. At the extreme end of this conversation, we are thinking, of course, about Aisling Murphy and about some of the 244 women who have been murdered in Ireland since 1996. And those names will be familiar to you. Nadine Lott, Uran Tsetseg Serendorje, Michaela Davis, Anna Creigel, Manuela Riedo. And the list goes on and on. So today we're talking about all the aspects of Irish and global society that underpins this male violence against women. And we're asking if this latest watershed is going to be the one that makes a difference in Ireland. I began by asking Alison O'Connor about her observations on watching proceedings in the Dáil yesterday.
You know, Roisin, I'm feeling more hopeful today. Before watching the Dáil proceedings yesterday, I hope she doesn't mind me mentioning it. I met Alva Smith for a coffee, the very well-known campaigner who has so many campaigns under her belt. And I was saying, oh, I don't know, Alva. I feel very kind of, you know, will it be just be the same all over again? Will something really happen out of this? And, you know, Alva basically said to me, you know, in a very polite way, you know, Alison, pull yourself up by your bootstraps here. You know, we have to be resilient in this. We have to take this moment for what it is and for all the opportunities that it presents, and not to be falling at the first hurdle and thinking, oh God, nothing is going to change. So that was the first thing that gave me pep in my step. And no better woman to do that for me. And then, you know, I'm a long time watching proceedings in the Dáil. You normally tune in and it is overwhelmingly male. It was even that the Dáil opened. It was the first time they were back after Christmas, and it opened with two female voices. The first two voices were female. The last Ciarán Comhairle was in the chair, Catherine Connolly, the Galway TD, who always speaks so well on these issues anyway, and expressed the condolences of the House to the Murphy family. And then Mary Lou MacDonald, the Sinn Féin leader, spoke and spoke really well, and spoke about, she talked about the internalised misogyny in Irish society. And then the Taoiseach spoke. And I suppose one of the things I was writing about myself was, this is a man now who has less than a year left in office, less than a year in power. And what a legacy for him to leave behind if this new plan that's coming out on violence, you know, gender-based violence, sexual violence, in a couple of weeks' time by the government, that if that was his stamp and that he made sure that all of that was completely bedded down securely before he walks out of the department of the Taoiseach next December, wouldn't that be quite something? And you have, in the Dáil, you have 160 deputies, 37 of those are women. I don't think all of them were in there. And there's distancing issues, to be fair. I saw, you know, people saying, why weren't there more men? But an awful lot of those women spoke, and they spoke of their own experiences. And there was a real feeling of raw emotion. And I'm sure even at times some of their male colleagues were surprised at that. Some of them even stood and spoke about how surprised they were that they had been so ignorant of these things. For instance, Cathal Crowe, the Fianna Fáil TD from Clare, talked about speaking to his wife and, you know, his surprise. And I really admired all that honesty. And there was a lot of, and I'll finish on this, and it did feel like a very significant day for me watching it. I was watching it online. There was a lot of reaching out across the floor. It started with the Taoiseach saying, we need everybody in on this. And that was, and the Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee, said the same. And that was reciprocated across the floor. There weren't efforts, not too many anyway, to politicise it and to make it a political football. And we can just hope and I suppose, and keep reminding the politicians of the promises, the pledges that they made, that something real will happen this time.
Thanks very much, Alison. I'm going to bring you in, Professor Orla Muldoon. You're a professor of psychology. You've written an awful lot about femicide. And I think in recent times, since Aisling Murphy's murder, you have been sort of joining a lot of dots for us about what are all the different things that are connecting into this men's violence against women. What are you thinking about today as we move forward? It's a week and it's 8 days since this happened.
I guess there was two things that struck me subsequent to last night's debate and subsequent really to what Alison is articulating there. The first one was that a TD said in the Dáil that this needed to be addressed. It couldn't be politics as usual, or this wasn't politics as usual. And the second thing is this feeling of inertia that many of us have, that we've been here before, or the problem is too big and there's nothing we can do. So the one thing I would say is that this could not be more political. It isn't political with a capital P, but it is political. And one of the things that may happen in the coming weeks and days is that the usual fault lines emerge around politics. So yes, we can all agree we don't want gender-based violence and we don't want men to be violent on our streets towards women or men. But how we go about that is very, very political. Gender quotas are political. Putting women on county councils is political. Making sure that there is positive discrimination in areas where women are underrepresented is political. Making gyms gender segregated. Making sure that men who catcall women are fined. All of these things are highly, highly political. So the idea that somehow that this is outside of politics is really, really a problematic thing to say. And some of the reason I say that is because the status quo is always easier. I'm totally with Alison. The phrase I was using last week was bone weary. I feel as if we've been talking about this, and certainly someone like me who spends their career studying it, it's like, could we move on to a new problem? So I do feel that we've spent a long time and we have lots of solutions, but actually the big block is willingness to address the issue, and it gets bound up in people who don't want the status quo to change. And that is both men and women.
I think that's a really, really important point. And before I move on to Innie and Finian, I just want to get you to remind our listeners what you have been writing about, because I suppose there is this talk about these incidents being random, you know, that being, you know, one bad man comes along and does something. But you, in your whole academic career, that's what you're looking at and studying. And can you talk to us about why that's not true?
Yeah, so if this was a lecture and I was doing my, you know, make sure you remember this. If we were talking about this form of violence in a lecture, I would say, make sure in your essay, when you answer me, that you don't call it random. This is asymmetrical violence. If this was random, we would have 200 balls in a lottery drum, and every ball would have a chance of coming out every time there was an instance of gender-based violence. So we have 100 pink balls and 100 blue balls. But actually, what keeps on happening is that pink balls with the numbers 15 to 35 keep coming out, and the drum and the entire environs is all blue, and the blue balls are pushing the pink balls out of the drum. If it was the case that every time we ran the lottery, pink balls came out aged, you know, 15 to 35 or 18 to 35, we'd stop buying the tickets. We'd say, this is not random. What we have here is asymmetrical violence. Men kill women. Women much more rarely kill men. People in dominant positions across the world kill more people than minority groups. We can see it in any conflict that you care to look at. So this is asymmetrical violence. So I guess if I wanted one thing, for people to take one thing from this podcast, is to stop calling it random and start calling it what it is, asymmetrical violence.
Well, I think that's, again, another really important point. And we might come back to looking at what exactly that means and where are the parts of the culture and society that we need to address. But Innie, I wanted to talk to you. You've got the weight of all the young people in Ireland on your shoulders. You're 20 years old. You're a final year student in DCU. I'm really curious to know how you and your friends have been processing this in the 8 days since Aisling's murder, and also just generally even before her murder, just the way you go about your lives. So what are the kind of conversations that you're having?
Well, the conversations, they're very heavy at the moment. Obviously, Aisling Murphy was only 22. She was so young. So the fact that it's someone our age, and just that it's not random, that it can happen to anyone. And we kind of have this mindset in the back of our heads that it can never really happen to us until it kind of does. But the conversations that we're having is the fact that, as Orla said, like, this isn't random. This gender-based violence is systemic. And the issue that we are really addressing, and we're really, I see it a lot on social media and when I'm talking to my friends, is that many men are harboring friends that are violent towards women, that do inappropriate things towards women. They catcall, they spike drinks, they rape girls. And the thing is that these individuals that abuse women, they're not outcasts in society. They're friendly people. They're charismatic. They're bubbly. They're very, very popular. So it's when you have a group, your lads group, and you know that your friend does these things, you know that they have that mindset, you need to call it out. if you don't want to report it to the guards, okay, but call it out. Even warn your female friends, warn other girls that are coming into the group. Let them be known that this person is not safe to be around. And I think it also kind of comes from this, like, even just internalized misogyny and even how we kind of raise our kids, the idea of teach your sons, because we're telling the whole issue, it kind of comes off as women's safety when it's really men's violent. So it's like, okay, put the pressure, the conversation that we're having right now, like even on this Zoom call, the majority is women that's here. It's women that are speaking about this problem when it really should be the men talking. I know that Finian is talking on this, but that's just what we're having here. It's saying that, okay, girls, don't walk late at night, don't walk in the dark, even though we have to. Like, you can't avoid not working, walking in the dark. Like, that's just life. But also tell your sons, don't hurt these women, leave them be. If you're walking and the boys catcall, you know, just be like, you know, that's not okay, don't do that. And it's even like, it starts from young, but even just a girl walking past a group of lads or even a singular lad, and he's like, oh, I just want to talk to you, but it's dark, it's late, and you're kind of like laughing nervously, just trying to get the conversation like quickly over with, because you know that if you reject him, he might get angry and he might attack her, and you don't know what will happen. So then again, it just kind of goes on the girl to be safe by entertaining a conversation that you don't know where it could go. So that's really where young people are. I know I can't speak for everybody, but that's the conversations that we're having.
And I was talking to you yesterday just in preparation for the podcast, and you had mentioned to me about something that seemed to be getting more prevalent was, and you mentioned it there a bit, the spiking of drinks. I mean, that's something that's very real in your socializing now, that these stories are happening to young women in your group.
Yeah, the spiking situation is just absolutely horrendous. And like I said before, you always think that it can never happen to me until it does. I know, like, one of my really close personal friends actually got spiked at the start of the semester, and I was doing a bit more research into it, and I saw that cases of spiking like go higher at the start of every academic year. And also with the fact that this academic year had started right after COVID, it was kind of like people were just waiting and planning to do all of these vicious things until they had the opportunity. It was an issue where people were walking around with needles and were spiking girls with needles, like in the club or even on campus, like places where you should be safe, places where you should be able to just like enjoy your life and have a good time. I was also reading that girls were wearing denim jackets because it was more difficult for the needle to penetrate through the fabric. And it's kind of sad in this day and age and this society that you have to think in that mindset. You have to think that way before you want to go out and have a nice, safe time with your friends. The situation was really, it was honestly worrying. It was scary how high it went. And after my friend had gone through that ordeal and she was in the hospital, it was just really traumatizing for her. And just talking to other people, and it was so common. It was like, oh yeah, this person's been spiked, that person's been spiked. Oh, have you not heard? Like, this is a thing. I'm like, there's no warning, there's no training, no one's telling you this. What about the young girls that are coming from secondary school into college for the first time? They don't know about this whole thing. So it's just, again, like, teach your sons, because at the end of the day, the people that are buying this GHB, GBH, whatever it is, whatever these drugs are on the dark web or whatever, it's so cheap. It's like 10 euro. You can buy it anywhere, but you're doing it with your friends. Your friends know who is doing this. So then again, like, the conversation really does go away from the girls, but more to the guys. Like, you know who your friends are, you know what they're up to, you know what they look forward to doing, and just call them out on it. Don't allow them to do that.
And I think I know your answer, but just to clarify, you haven't heard of any women going around with these needles and spiking men at night?
Not to my knowledge. It doesn't seem to be as popular. It really is something that's, even talking to some of my male friends, they walk around and they say, sorry, Annie, but we don't really, that's not really in our mind. That worry isn't something that we have to worry about in this day and age. I'm sure perhaps maybe there are cases, but not to my knowledge, no.
Okay. Well, that's a good time to bring you in, Finian. And again, not putting the pressure of all men on your shoulders, but it was important to us to have a man on the podcast today, because I think, going back to what Alison was saying, if this is a moment and if it is something that maybe where there is some change, I think one of those changes is going to be more men being involved. And you have for a number of years been trying to get other men to get involved in this. So tell me what you're thinking about at the moment and what you're hearing from your male friends.
Well, thanks for having me on, Roisin. Yeah, I think, you know, Alison mentioned Av Smith, and she was speaking in Dunleary on Saturday night at a vigil. And I think she made that, as she always does, that insightful call that this is a collective effort and that we can work together on this. So I too am hopeful, but we need to do a lot of work. We being men, I think, you know, it's been talked about quite a lot about how aware have men been about this problem. I think sadly, you know, for me, I'm in my late 30s. I've always been aware of it, but I think I have turned a blind eye at times. And there's been, a really important talk about the spectrum that leads to male violence. We're beginning, I think, to recognize that and start unpacking moments that we have turned that blind eye. And if we hadn't, what could have changed? What consequence could have been made? So I think, if anything, what's happened in the past week in conversations has been, you know, men beginning to see the scale and the breadth and the everyday sexism and the compounding effect that's occurring in terms of maintaining the culture of accepting this. And we are now getting to the stage where we're able to define things that are unacceptable. And in just in preparation for this conversation today, I kept on thinking of the phrase that I was going to use over and over. I don't mean this in defense, but what I would suggest is that we as men have been pretty poor at educating ourselves or being educated about this. And I looked back on research from 2006, where when asked about, sex education or relationships, less than half of men, so those men that are now in their 30s and 40s, less than half had actually had education about relationships, about how to behave in a relationship, how to express emotions, how to get through negotiations. And of those, very few had actually had a conversation with their dad. Usually it was mum. I had a chat with my mum, but very few other men had a conversation with their father. So there hasn't been this intergenerational transfer of simply how to, on specific situations, have a relationship with women. There is these overarching views that we should be respectful, chivalrous, but in certain situations, there hasn't been that guiding voice, that mentorship. And so, you know, my 5-year-old boy now, in the past week, we've I've listened to the debate about whether or not to speak to children about this. But I think throughout my relationship with him, I am reminding him that there is a difference, that there is an inequality, and it shouldn't be the case. What's delightful about him is he doesn't think that should be either. This is, you know, this is insane to him that this can be the case. But it has to happen over and over again. That's an effortful aspect. I need to educate myself on it. And if I may just briefly mention then, from a peer point of view, Roisin, and we might talk about this further on, we need to figure out, the language that we use. I think Innie, your point is so spot on about calling out that behaviour. I'm hopeful because I think about, the pathetic behaviour or situations of stag weekends. I've been on some great stag weekends. But often a stag is a collection of people that don't know each other. So you have this kind of representative group of lads. And you're thrown into this WhatsApp group a week beforehand to organise the logistics. And there'll always be one out of the 10 who will try to, check the temperature of the water, say a sexist joke or maybe a pornographic material. And majority of people will say nothing back. But then you realise on the stag, maybe two or three will begin to call out this guy's behaviour. But there's still six people in the middle who say nothing. They are deeply uncomfortable. They know this doesn't represent who they are, but they're not saying anything. So we need to stop this silence, and we need to recognise that there are other men who will stand beside us and figure out a way to say this is unacceptable and change that. Easier said than done. But I am hopeful. I think, Professor Louise Crowley's bystander intervention program, bring it on, because we need that education. We need ways to be able to call this out.
Finian, just remind people about the bystander theory and what that's about, because some people might not have come across it before.
So I think there's often, again, thinking about this, you see an unacceptable statement or an attitude or a behaviour, and you want to intervene or you want to step in. So it could be, catcalling on the street. You might from a distance ask the victim if they're okay. You might get an authority involved. Essentially, it's a way to unpack ways in which you can intervene and support somebody. Sadly, that can often escalate to male violence on males, and that's often the reason why people don't step in. But we have to figure out ways we can manage that.
Thanks, Finian. Alison, listening to Finian there and thinking about men, and maybe your male friends, or what are you feeling, or is there something different, and is the conversation moving on, do you feel?
I guess one of the things that fascinated me listening to Finian, who I thought explained his perspective on things really well, was even that insight into when he mentioned the male stag going on a stag, I found myself going, oh, Jesus, I hadn't even thought about the stag. the stories that we have heard over the years. And it is, I find it really interesting, because it is like the mysteries of the male WhatsApp group. And I have heard various female friends who have wonderful husbands, from what I know of them and what I hear about them. But even in scenarios like that, the sports WhatsApp or something like a stag, and where they just let it pass. I was kind of fascinated to hear Finian say that then maybe when they get together, that's when the dynamic is established as to who calls them out or who doesn't. I suppose I'm semi-surprised, because I was left with more of an impression. I wonder how prevalent that is. And again, this goes back to something that I have been thinking over the last few days. You can't, and Orla would know, I'm sure, has looked into this, like, as to what is our baseline here? How bad is it? And if that doesn't sound overly negative, I suppose we're just coming out of the brutal murder of Ashley Murphy. So it feels like things are fairly bad. I think it's important to make that point, because there are so many men who are feeling that there's a bit that there's an hysteria has taken hold, that it is, that how men are not going around murdering women in broad daylight, willy-nilly, as it were, that this is at the apex of a whole host of things at different levels. If you call the ground level of it the catcalling, that sort of thing, and you move up from there. And I think it's also, it's contemporary. It's all the things we have just discussed. And I mean, I sat listening to Annie as a mother of two girls, and I obviously have heard about spiking, all of that sort of thing, but I mean, my stress levels, and my girls are a couple of years away from that sort of socialising, but just felt a level of disbelief listening to what she was saying. So there's the contemporary, but I think in Irish society, there is also the historic, in terms of why this tragic episode has had such, has just seemed to light a fire under Irish women. And if you permit me, Roisin, I sat down the other night to do sort of pretty quickly a list where I thought that put it in context, that showed there is a continuum in this. And for me anyway, of why that's the situation. I mean, I'd start with the mother and baby homes, the mother and child scheme, even some physiotomy, the dominance of the Catholic Church. I spoke earlier about, the Dáil, and even the low level of female TDs we have, women at cabinet. the political parties who, despite the quotas, you know, just a lot of the time still just do the bare minimum. I was thinking about the IRFU and what we've heard recently of their treatment of female players, that when you see the GAA Congress meeting every year, it looks, I'm sure there's a couple of women in there, but if you look at them, if you look at it, it flashes up on the telly on a Saturday night and it just looks like wall-to-wall blokes. Don't talk to me about the crowd at Portmarnock Golf Club, who only last year decided to admit women. You know, if there's anything guaranteed to get me started, it's those jerks. It's what goes on in schools with sex education, consent, you know, the fact that religious ethos is allowed now. This was a real moment for me yesterday in the Dáil when the Taoiseach said that would change, because Breed Smith stood and said that they had proposed, you know, new legislation. And, you know, what was the story with that? So I felt like that was quite a moment. And then the talking to kids, then I connected it on to handing your child, be it a boy or a girl, a smartphone with access to the internet, where there's access to porn, and not speaking to them about it, to me is parentally criminal thing to do. I also looked at the media, how women aren't promoted as voices of authority. It's often as a victim, and even about the lack of, particularly in newspapers, of women at senior levels. You know, that there's far more of that, you know, that the media will be the first to call out the rest of society, but could also do what's looking in its own eye. We've mentioned the WhatsApp groups. I had that in my list. I had about the bosses that pay men more and don't promote women as much. I was saying about the men who refuse to take their heads out of their own posteriors in terms of it's not all men, making it about them rather than making it about the issue. And it's also that it was to do with the levels of alcohol in this country. And that is directly related for me to the levels of domestic violence. And that is then, you bring that into the pandemic and how the rates of domestic violence have absolutely exploded. And I think people were very aware of that. And the amount of women stuck in their homes the last 2 years with an abusive partner. And there's a story in the Irish Times today by Mary Carlin saying that less than 1 in 5 people accused of a domestic violence offence that came before the Dublin Metropolitan District Courts in 2019 and in 2020 was convicted. So that's less than 1 in 5 were convicted. And that's data from the court service. And also that there are significantly more applications to strike out or withdraw domestic violence proceedings. So that would end them. That's what that basically means. So significantly more of those before the Dublin courts than for any other type of offences. So, I mean, you just think, like, what? You can have all the policies you like and throw all the resources at it. But if you don't have convictions, you know, you're missing a really key part. And then finally, for me, in my list, and I've had other suggestions from other people on this list, it's Article 41.2 of our Constitution, which is referred to as a woman's place being in the home. That is still remains there. And I don't think we're going to be seeing the back of it anytime soon.
Yeah, I was hoping that we might be a bit more hopeful on this podcast, but now you've made me all depressed again, Alison. But I'm going to come to you, Orla, no pressure, but solutions wise, I mean, you're very good at articulating the patterns that lead to this across society, and that the fact that it's asymmetrical and systemic, as Innie said. Where do you see the most urgent work needs to be done? And Helen McEntee has said, you know, this isn't reactive, this new strategy, this zero tolerance strategy she's come up with. She's been working on it for a year. She seems to have real, as Alison said, fire in her belly about this and a determination. I was very struck by her talking about her young son as well and how she's going to raise him. And it seems like Alison was saying, very personal at the moment for a lot of the women and the men as well, like Barry Cowan was very powerful in his contribution from Tullamore and talking about it's not right that women aren't safe. So Orla, where do you see the work needs to go now and the real practical stuff that will mean lasting change and will actually make this a watershed moment?
Yeah, and I think so, to counter some of the negativity, because I do think that we need to kind of keep our chins up and push on, because the alternative is to do nothing. So I'd go back to things that both Alison and Finian said about the role of the collective. So I think the biggest single change that we've seen in the last 5 to 10 years is probably in Innie's generation, who are now willing to say that these things have happened to them. So instead of rape and sexual violence being stigmatized, and people, not that it isn't still stigmatized, but, in, you know, people are now saying, no, it's happened to me. So what people thought was their individual fault, they're connecting that. So I think what's happening at vigils and in this moment is actually powerful for that reason, because it allows me to connect to somebody else who's had a similar experience. And instead of seeing it as, you know, I was attacked because I wore a short skirt, I was attacked because I forgot to wear my denim jacket, or whatever nonsense reason you can do to individualize the issue, that people begin to see the pattern and that they see that what's going on. So I guess one of the biggest things we could do is relocate the source of the problem. And it is men's violence, whether it's violence against women or violence against men, but it is men's violence. So my first suggestion is that we stop asking women about how much violence they have experienced, because we know that they've experienced a lot now. And instead, we start asking men how much violence have they perpetrated. So the estimates in the UK are that 1 in 10 university students admit to date rape. And that is really akin to what Finian said, that in a WhatsApp, there's 1 in 10. So I think it's really interesting, and we should start looking at what is actually driving that behaviour in men. What is it that is supporting that sort of behaviour? And I guess the other thing I would say is, and I love now hashtag, so I'm going to go with it, is one of the things in the research that we do is it's very clear that women that aren't believed have much more severe mental health outcomes. So a big thing all men and all women could do is believe her. When she says what happened to her, believe her. Because certainly in the last week, when I haven't been called a feminazi or an angry feminist, I've been called hysterical. So we often move to these tropes where we actually undermine women's mental health or undermine their ability or their competence. And if one of the things that you find is that women who go into the judicial system and have rotten experiences in there, that they tend to have much poorer mental health outcomes. And then the last thing I would say, building on Alison's point, is that the judiciary is a problem. There is lots of evidence that we need education and training in those who are involved in the implementation of justice. And I think there are probably, considering how many cases are getting to court around rape, and now we're seeing domestic violence, we actually need to really question how it is that people secure a conviction. In work that we did, it's about 5 or 6 years ago, one of the family law judges, these would have been progressive people who agreed to be interviewed, one of the judges used the phrase ordinary decent domestic violence to refer to family law cases in his court. God. So I think we have a long, long way to go with the judiciary. And I put that into the I believe her regime, because some of what we do in the court system is we require women to repeatedly demonstrate that what they say is true. So I think we need to really enact the, and I think women as well as men need to believe her.
That sounds like a huge, huge mountain to climb, Orla. I don't want to go down the pessimistic route though, but do you feel that this moment that we're having, and the court service particularly being highlighted with the domestic violence, and it's not just that, it's the rape cases, it's the low convictions in that across the board. Is there a sense, do you think, that this might change?
yeah, we can tinker around the edges or we can go full throttle. I mean, I'm happy for either. I do think, to go back to the positive, I do think that there has been change. For someone of my generation, the idea that you would admit to have been raped was just, I mean, I honestly don't know if I could have told my parents. Whereas I think now that there is an understanding that actually it isn't the fault of the woman if she's raped. So I do think there has been change, and the strength comes from each other. The strength comes from revealing the patterns and seeing that you've experienced it and I've experienced it. And we've, too many of us have had this experience, and from finding that there are men who are saying, no, this isn't an exit. Don't include me in that number. I don't want to be. That is not the Ireland I want. I want an Ireland where we are all safe. So I really do think that we have progress, but it is slow. I think there are things we could change in the court system, you know, quite quickly. I think we could introduce, you know, people are always very quick to say, oh, we need to change what's taught in the schools. Do you know, stop making children be the one to deliver the change. Why don't the adults lead? You know, why don't the leaders lead?
The new Safe Ireland Survivor Fund, in partnership with Airbnb, enables Safe Ireland to contribute to sustainable supports for women and frontline services and to provide focused actions for children. You can play a critical role in helping to protect more women and children from abuse. Donate directly to your local domestic violence service or to the national work of Safe Ireland. Go to www.safeireland.ie for more information.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Just one man had a suggestion, Innie. I'd be interested to see what you think of this. Michael Healy-Ray was talking about legalising mace so that women can carry mace around with them and they'll be able to spray off their attackers and everything will be fine then. What do you think about that? What would your friends say about that suggestion?
Legalising mace in Ireland, I think it would be, I feel like it could go both ways. I know that mace is legal in other countries and it's not like it's completely eradicated the problem. The problem is still very prevalent. So I don't think that that's 100% the way to go. But it would kind of have a bit of a reassurance. I think I would like to walk with mace in my bag. I would like to have that, just even if you're in a close encounter and you just don't feel safe. Yeah, it would be a nice way to go, but it's definitely not the one thing that is going to completely eradicate the issue.
And Dini, just on that then, because you're 20, so walking around now, just tell me a bit about that. I'm really curious because I wasn't expecting you to say that. You actually feel you would feel a bit more comfortable walking around with some kind of weapon, essentially, in your bag. Yeah.
Well, girls walk around with their keys in their hand, already on guard. Like, that's something that's already being done. Walking around, like, even in the daylight, it's just like when you are approached by someone that, like, it's trust your gut instinct, that if you feel off, you know, just to kind of protect yourself. But even being, like, to take intersectionality into the situation, being a black woman walking in Dublin city centre and then a white man randomly screams, "Go back to your country." I don't know if he has a knife with him. I don't know if he has something else with him. I don't know if he's just being a bigot. So it's like, oh my gosh, ignore, put your head down, run to the bus, run home, whatever it is. Or like some people might turn around, but you're told not to ever confront or not to ever engage, just to take it as it is and go home, because what else can you do? Because like I said, you don't know if they have a knife or whatever it is. You don't know their intentions. So it's really like, it's sad, obviously, to not be able to kind of feel safe walking or jogging in that time of the day or any time of the day, really, especially when there's like kind of larger groups of people as well. But it's just something that you kind of have to head on. That's how I feel. Like, even to this day, like, I'm 20, and ever since I just started going outside, my dad will always be at me, "It's dark, it's late, get home, where are you?" I'm like, "Why are you saying this? Let me live, let me be." But my younger brother, who's doing the exact same thing, he's not getting shouted at to get back home. Because, and I asked my dad, I was like, "Why? Why is it one rule for me, one rule for him?" And he simply replied, "Because he's a boy." And that's just it. And obviously, like, that's not fun, but that's the society that we live in. So yeah, walking around with your keys in your hand or walking around on the phone to a friend, your earphones are in, but the music is not playing because you have to be aware of your surroundings. All these things that we do, having your location on so that somebody knows where you are at every point of the day. It's just preventative measures, but they can only go so far. At the end of the day, it's sad, but it is what it is.
Thanks very much for that, and I'm really glad you brought in the intersectional aspect as well, because that's a whole other it shouldn't be another conversation. It's part of this conversation, and anybody who's different or minority or any of that gets all of these things much worse, and we need to keep that in our mind as well. Finian, I think you and I were at the same event that Caitlin Moran did one time, where she was talking about how men need to have a movement, that women have been brilliant at organising themselves and being passionate about these subjects and really making change, but men need to get on board and realise that they can come together. Going back to the collective, you started on Farella a few years ago trying to reach out to men. Tell us about that and about the possibility in your eyes, whether it's something that could happen, where men could have some kind of positive movement to take action on these things we've been talking about.
I think it should happen, but we're really bad at talking about this stuff. It's not an excuse, but we have to. So I'm ambitious, I'm hopeful, but I think it's going to be a slow burner. That said, I am hopeful, because I think particularly in Ireland, men are primed for this. We have been forced to understand the other experience. You know, we've my generation has been through two momentous referendum, both marriage equality and repeal, where it's been put in front of us, you know, this is the world beyond us. And, I say that as a cis white man. And I think we're beginning to figure out how we can kind of understand the world through a different lens. And that is why I'm hopeful. And, you know, there's been events like the Belfast rape trial, which, you know, instigated so many conversations amongst my peers. And that was, I think, a moment like that where you could bring this up, you know, across a pint and debate it. You know, there's been heated debates, and that is where we figure out a consensus. But in terms of the movement aspect of it, Roisin, I think, you know, the first step to being involved in a kind of mobilization side of it is at the individual level. And so there's the inward and the outward. And I think from an inward perspective, I'm still doing it. I think we all need to start looking at those moments where, you know, to Orla's point, you know, how have you contributed to violence? How have you been aggressive? How have you raised your voice? We have all done it, because that's what we were told as young men. Boys will be boys, the worst, you know, phrase in the world. That is acceptable. That's the way you address. We have two default emotions, grand and anger. And we need to figure out, you know, what is the spectrum? Why are we feeling like this? And then to cool it down. And I think that's going to be uncomfortable. You know, I've been thinking about moments, you know, in my 20s where I didn't say anything, where I participated through silence or I participated through a contribution. Once we acknowledge that, I then, you know, we can bring those anecdotes and say, remember that time when, yeah, you know, I wonder how they feel now. What could we have done differently? And I do think there is a willingness. It'll take time, but, you know, I listened to women's podcasts for years, so
I love you, Finian. You know, you're so
men
great.
Men listening to I presume I'm not the only one, Rosie.
I don't know about that.
Know, to the lads listening in, like I think, you know, the beauty of the patriarch is it convinces us all that we're going to get to the top of the bullshit pyramid scheme, and it's not. We're all being sucked into the lie. And so to those that are listening, like, you know, there are other ways of being a decent guy out there. And, you know, to any like I look forward to the day where we can walk down the street and just nod and smile at each other and know that we're both coming from a good place. And, you know, that's the hope that we can get through this, because there's enough of us out there to make this change.
Gorshin, can I ask you, one of the things I'm really curious about that Orla would be in a place to answer, and actually before I do that, Orla, just to say to sort of journalistically in terms of selling your message, I made a note here that you mentioned earlier about asymmetrical violence. You academics are going to have to come up with a different term. That's shocking. No one knows what that. No one will identify with that.
I'm so glad you said that, Alison, because I just said it there back to Orla. And even as I was saying it, I was like, all I can see is lottery balls, but I can't really remember what she's talking about.
But so that's it. You know, you can go back to us on that, Orla. And I could listen to you all day. But one of the things I've been wondering about, and it's going back kind of to the list and even the more historic stuff and the place of women, like, how do we rate compared to other comparable, you know, countries? How bad are we?
How bad are we? Lord, did you just listen to yourself? So, okay, I'll take the hit for asymmetrical violence, but I'd like to say, how good are we and how good could we be?
Fair enough.
on some of the comparators, like if you take something like the World Value Survey or some of these big, or even the European Social Survey, we're not as good as the Scandinavians, but we're not as bad as the Polish. But of course, one of the issues around all of this is that there is serious underreporting. So sometimes a very good country can look like a bad country because they report well, if I'm making sense. Yeah. So because you're documenting everything, you look like you have a lot of an issue, but actually what you have is excellent transparency.
I want to know how full or empty everyone's glass is about this topic, really. And we've kind of had a little bit of talk about hope and change and stuff. But I want to ask you, Alison, specifically as someone who monitors the political life in this country so closely, what you think about the Helen McEntee sort of proposed strategy, and whether that, you know, being in the Department of Justice exclusively, you know, all these around all the legislation that's going to come in. She's already said about the non-fatal strangulation, that she's going to make that a crime, and the stalking stuff. So it does seem to be quite practical, and it's all going to be start kicking off in the next few weeks. And it's going to, it sounds like, have huge ramifications across a lot of areas. Are you hopeful on that will actually see change and make things better?
I'd just like to start by saying that I'm even far more generally hopeful after this conversation and the importance of broadening it out. And you know, I was already a fan of Orla's, but listening to Finian and Ennie and getting the younger perspective, as Ennie said, as her experience as a young Black woman, Finian's experience of it's the importance of that, the incredible importance of hearing, you know, different voices, and that we're not just talking to ourselves, and that you educate yourself. So yes, going back to the political thing to try and make, now, as Atishik said yesterday, you know, you can have all the change in the world, but it's the culture, you know, culture will eat law and all of that for breakfast unless you work at that point. So I think it's a good thing. I mean, out of a horrible tragedy is a good thing that we happened to have this new government program plan due out in a couple of weeks' time, so that there's this new impetus behind it.
that the Department of the Taoiseach is going to have an overarching role, that Helen McEntee talked about the zero tolerance. And I think Helen McEntee is feeling it very strongly herself as a woman. And even, and this fits to what any telling her story and Orla saying that younger women are, even Helen McEntee speaking about feeling unsafe herself. I think that that's of her generation, that she was, that she as a minister, that she spoke of that. You know, the announcement of more refuge places, I think it is really important. But going back to what I said earlier, the fact that it swept through the Dáil chamber, that there would be, that there was agreement on this. And even that you have a committee on gender that was set up in the Oireachtas recently to push through the assembly, our recent citizens assembly, the recommendations. And I mean, it fascinates me to think that that was not due to discuss violence against women, gender-based violence, until they got enough public submissions saying you have to. So that's there as well. So I think on a whole host of levels. But yes, will the system have to be held accountable? Will we have to keep coming back to that, reminding? I mean, it'll be a horrible thing that this time next year, minus a week on Aisling Murphy's anniversary, we will be looking back to see what has been done.
Yeah, well, I think we should definitely do that. I'm glad we've made you more hopeful, and I hope that continues and you don't plummet back into the depths of despair again. I'm going to come to you, Orla, as well. How's your glass looking at the moment?
It's looking, I suppose, I would call myself a realist. So it looks like there's a bit of water in it. Do you know whether that's full or empty? I don't know.
This is getting very existential now.
I'd never ask the nerd on. I guess, you know, we've had cross-party agreements before. Think of Sláinte Care. Do you know, like, cross-party agreements won't necessarily deliver. I totally agree with Alison around the culture is eating everything else for breakfast. And I think that's probably where we need, you know, how do we do things around here? But as well as national level culture or male culture or female culture, we also have subcultures. And I think one of the interesting things that Finian refers to there is, you know, the 1 in 10, and what happens when that 1 in 10 finds a second fella in the WhatsApp group or a third fella? You know, how did we end up with the WhatsApp group like the one that was talked about at the Belfast rape trial? So that's actually where we need to really worry. People find each other easier now online. So I think actually we need to think about how it is we crack those kind of bubbles that can be kind of curses around change, so that those groups can cause a lot of damage. I do think we can get power from each other, and that is cultural too. And I think we should continue to do that. But we need to be aware of these subcultures that can grow, that can actually be very damaging. And I think we need legislation around all of this online stuff. I know we haven't spoken much about that, but to me, we have a whole area where people, women mostly, are being abused in terms of videos being taken and shared and all of this. And it's actually even difficult to get that viewed as a complaint, as a crime. So and that they sustain those subcultures, those problematic subcultures. So I don't know. I'll continue to drink, okay. And I will continue to push, because I think the alternative is to do nothing, and I just don't think that's an option.
No, that's absolutely true. Innie, what about you? I mean, you're a young woman, you're out there, you're, you know, perhaps sort of coming up against a lot of what we're talking about more than maybe we are. I'm in my house most of the time, to be honest. I don't get out much, Innie. So are you feeling like this whole conversation, I mean, at the same time, there's a grieving family, you know, maybe none of this is going to do any good to them. But I did notice at the funeral mass there, I was very struck that Aisling's cousin, I think she was English, she actually, in the prayer of the faithful, mentioned men's violence against women and hoped that this might see a sort of something different happening. So I presume it's very much on their minds, as well as everything else they're going through at the moment. So how do you see it? Do you think this is a moment of change, that something might happen?
I definitely think that in this era that we live in, this digital era, where we have we're able to communicate with people on a worldwide level, I feel like awareness and conversation and just breaking stigma is so, so important. Having conversations such as the Me Too movement is so, so huge. Just being able to share your stories and know that it's not just you. I know that this is happening, and bring conversations just amongst your friends. Like, you would be very surprised what the butterfly effect that comes from just talking to one person, and it changes their mindset and how they go about things. So honestly, my glass is always half full. I am always looking at the positive side of things. I like to hope for a better future, and the future is our generation and the generation below us, you know, like just how we think about things, how we go about the future, and just what we accept as what is okay. And the thing is that we are allowed to accept what is okay. We draw the line, we draw the boundaries. And I feel like that we need to emphasize that we as women, we have so much power as well. And that's another thing that I feel like we're underestimated for. It. We have a lot of power. We can decide what's shit to take and what shit not to take. So I think that that's a line that needs to be drawn, and just to emphasize that in schools, in family homes, and amongst friends.
Innie, I love that, because you know, during all this what's happened, you inevitably, I'm sure Alison's been doing, I know Kathy Sheridan wrote a brilliant piece yesterday.
Yeah.
I'm sure Orla, you have the same thing. We reflect on all the things that have happened to us and the shit we did take, Innie. I mean, I was thinking about, you know, stuff that happened in Christmas parties, work related things that were just that went on, and you never got to say, hang on, this is absolutely terrible. You just had to swallow it down and carry on. And this week I had two male friends, employers, ringing me to just talk to me about incidences that had happened in the workplace around men's very inappropriate behaviour to women. And in both cases, those men have been fired immediately. Yeah. Without any equivocation. It was just bring them in. Did you do this? Yes, you did. Well, you're out. See you at the door. And I was absolutely like amazed that that's the way in, and not, I know that's not in all workplaces, but certainly that would have been unthinkable, you know, even 10,
well,
15,
I can,
20 Roisin, years ago.
I can confirm, having been at some of the same Christmas parties as you
I think we're getting a bit worried.
Yeah, but
now,
you know, I want to say, I don't want to sound patronizing, right, to any, but I mean, I'm just watching her and thinking, wow, you know, if this is you at 20, I'm dying to see what you're going to be at 30. And that's given me such optimism to hear that. And I think that, you know, that Innie and her generation have that optimism gives me hope.
Yeah. And, you know, we have to also mention, I didn't say it to you, Alison, you know, she's a final year law student. So isn't that good?
I wondered. Fantastic. Law, definitely to the benefit of the legal profession.
Well, I think
thank you.
I think in the spirit of the way this conversation has been going, we should leave the last word to Finian, the man on the panel. Where is your glass? There's water in Orla's. How's yours looking?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's to find a better word, but I'll use excited and enthused. You know, when I attended the vigil on Saturday night, it was obviously a moment of reflection, but you know, the volume and the growing diversity, not enough, I don't think, but definitely the greater representation of men in the group and the crowd, is built on the back, I think, of particularly young women over the past decade working really hard to address the social issues in our society. And, you know, that's a very exciting moment, not just on this important issue, but on so many. So I can't but be hopeful. But I think, you know, to Orla's point about being a realist, we have to work. There has to be an effort on this. So, you know, whether you're doing this for people you know or doing this for the collective good, you have to do something. And I'll, you know, like a broken record, say again, there's plenty of men out there, but, you know, let's check ourselves and make this a conversation, as much as I despise talking about football on a Monday morning, as normalized as that. Because if we can call out, you know, our football team's poor, you know, game on a Saturday, so too can we talk about the behavior of a friend or an attitude that they're expressing. And it's gradual, but like everyday sexism, I think it has to be everyday address as well. So, yeah, let's say it's half full and we'll fill it up.
Mine's half full too, because that's the way I am. But I'm also, as Alison said, really hopeful after this conversation. I'm really grateful to you all for being so interesting and reflective and thoughtful on this subject. And I just want to finish with Finian's recent tweet, actually. He said in relation to Aisling Murphy, "This is all men. This is every single one of us. Each one of us is a role model to other men. In our lives, all of us have been sexist, and this allows for evil abuses, assaults and murders of women to happen. This needs to end. Men need to stop being violent. It is on us men." So thanks, Finian, for coming on. And thanks to all of you for talking about this. And I would like to propose a date on that sad anniversary in a year. Let's come together and see what has happened and whether what we hoped did come true, or and how much that strategy has worked, because I think it will be very interesting to do that. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Roisin.
That's all we have time for. Thanks so much to Alison O'Connor, Professor Orla Muldoon, Ini Ekiolu and Finian Murphy. And do let us know your thoughts on what's been going on at the moment and the reflections that are going on in houses up and down the country. We'd really like to hear your input and any aspects of this subject that you'd like us to cover in more detail. We're all ears. You can get in touch with us on social at IT Women's Podcast. We're on Instagram or Twitter, and we're on email, thewomenspodcast@irishtimes.com. That's it from me. The podcast is produced by me, Roisin Ingle, by Suzanne Brennan and Jennifer Ryan, with JJ Vernon on sound. Mind yourselves, and I'll talk to you next time.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.